Hi, this is Erin, and in this production, we're going to be talking to Anna Horakovich of Mochi Mochi Land. She's a knitter and author, and we sat down and talked with her when she came to visit the library in July of 2013 and did a series of programs and installations. You can also get her patterns for free on our website for download. And for more information about Mochi Mochi Land, visit mochimochiland.com. First, let's start with, you know, your appearance here in Ann Arbor has been, we invited you as part of our summer game. And so this week we have a badge that the kids, a virtual badge, is sort of like on Foursquare, that the kids can earn. And we made the whole badge about your artistic influences. So they're going to learn about some of the different people that you listed. So can you talk a little bit about that? We mentioned Pee Wee's Playhouse, Mary Blair.
Okay, so artistic influences. Well, I didn't go to art school. I was never an art student. So I don't have maybe some of the more conventional artistic influences. But I certainly grew up with lots of pop culture that I go back to now as things that have really inspired the things that I do. A lot of TV shows, like The Muppet Babies, for example, just things that really encourage a lot of imagination and wacky characters like that. There's actually somebody now who inspires me quite a lot is a team of artists called APAC. I think they're in Washington State, I want to say, and they just create these beautiful paintings and also sculptures with some characters that they've created, and they make these just magical worlds around them that are really charming. So I'd encourage anybody to check them out. It's just APAK.
Okay.
Also I have a lot of inspiration from Japan, Japanese characters, not so much anime and manga, but more like Hello Kitty. And the very
are you a Totoro simple fan?
Oh yeah. I love those movies for sure. Like the way that characters in Japan, they definitely have a different type of personality, I think, especially compared to the ones that I grew up with in the US, which I loved, but they're in Japan you'll find characters that are much more subtle and less kind of in your face mm-hmm. and wacky. And I love the fact that in Japan even adults can be surrounded right. by characters, and it's not really weird. I actually, when I lived there for a little while, I was an exchange student, and there is my local bank that I went to. Everything inside was like this Pepto-Bismol pink, and they had like these adorable characters awesome. As just the banking mascot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of Japan, just talk about how you ended up living there and what that time there, you know, how that influenced you, and did you by any chance go to Piro Land? The Sanrio amusement park.
Yeah, I did, in fact, when I was like 18.
Okay.
Originally, my interest in Japan started when my family, I grew up in Oklahoma, my family had an exchange student come live with us from Japan. Her name was Yoshiko.
Okay.
And I was, I think, 12 years old at the time. So we had an age difference. She was like a high school senior, but we became really good pals. And it's a little bit embarrassing, but the one thing that made me decide for sure I had to go to Japan was her mother would send her these packages just full of candy. Mm-hmm. And it was just the strangest, most adorable candy with really fun packaging. And I was like, I have to see where this
yes.
comes from. So I was determined to get there someday. And I did end up being an exchange student myself, not with her family, but, you know, just later on when I was older. So I lived there for a year then, and then in college I studied Japanese, and I spent another year there after
okay.
college.
So how much traveling have you done in Japan? Like, do you feel like you've seen the country? Did you spend more time in Tokyo or other cities?
I've seen quite a bit of it, actually. I lived mostly around Nagoya, which is a pretty large city that's not too far from Tokyo. But it is a country that's really easy to get around in with the trains. So I've had a chance to go to most of the islands and see the ice sculptures in Hokkaido and see the beaches in Okinawa.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So does Piro Land live up to the hype, or what was your opinion of that?
Well, I did feel like maybe I was a little bit old for it because
yeah.
it did seem a little geared toward younger kids.
Okay.
But it was pretty amazing, like just to see, be surrounded by these characters mm-hmm. and I mean, I was a little obsessed just with the products that they had there. So I just like bought up a ton of stationery.
Yeah.
Was pretty much my souvenir from there.
I have not been to Japan. I want to go desperately. And I always think that when I get there, I'm going to like have overload, like just with some of the places you go where there's just tiny plastic, beautiful colored things. Does that fulfill your destiny? Was there plenty of that to keep you? I mean, I wonder, does Sanrio have stores there as well like they do here, or is it a little more integrated?
They do have, if I remember correctly, I think like within department stores, they'll have like a little Sanrio mini store, I think. I mean, for me, I did learn as I was there that Japan was more than just cute characters and stuff. But so I feel like I should say that. But yeah, it was a big draw for me, and I still just love the playfulness and just the novelty that does seem important to everyone there, to always have new stuff coming out.
Yeah.
And it can be really overwhelming, especially with the language. But I've always personally had really wonderful experiences with the people there. And I think having that balance of like the really old culture and learning about things like flower arrangement and
right.
then combining that with the crazy neon lights and everything.
Yeah.
It's a really cool combination.
Did the name of Mochi Mochi Land, was it directly influenced by Japan in that regard then?
Yes, it certainly was. Mochi, maybe you've heard of that. It's like a sticky rice.
Right.
Sweet. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things in Japan. It's like this delicious treat.
Are they like small little colored ball things that have things in them? Is that it?
Well, they actually come in different forms.
Okay.
There's all different types of mochi. But I think in America, a lot of people know the ice cream.
That's what I'm
mochi.
Thinking of.
Yeah. Those are delicious. So I was kind of obsessed with them, especially in Japan, where I could find all different kinds.
Right.
And when I was trying to come up with a name just for my website, I went back to that because I had an email address with Mochi in it. And I was like, I want to have something with Mochi. And of course, Mochi.com was taken. So it kind of turned into Mochi Mochi and then Mochi Mochi Land.
Okay.
But actually, it worked out kind of nicely because having it be land, I from the beginning I was kind of thinking of creating a place, and mochi mochi, by the way, is a word itself with the two of the repeated words. It's one of those, it's kind of like an onomatopoeia that means something like mochi, like sticky and squishy.
So
it does also has that meaning, and so I'm pretty happy that that's what I ended up with.
It fits perfectly. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, your progression to getting to form Mochi Mochi and what that kind of looked like when you decided that you were going to do it?
Yeah, well, it really started, I actually learned to knit in Japan when I was there from one of my host sisters. So it's kind of interesting that I have that origin with my knitting as well, although I wasn't really hardcore into it. She just taught me how to do it, how to make a scarf. And I kept knitting when I went back to the U.S. in high school, or not high school, sorry, college. And I have a mother-in-law who's very crafty, so she was always very encouraging of that. I did reach a point after a couple years after college at which I felt like maybe knitting was kind of, I don't know, I had run out of people to make things for. I still enjoyed it, but I didn't really know what to make next, kind of. And it just happened that I was working at an art gallery in New York. And it was the opening of the gallery. And I wanted to make something for my coworkers to kind of commemorate that. And we had a logo for the gallery. So I tried to make some little creatures based on that logo, because it looked a little bit like a blobby creature. So I kind of sketched out the basic shape of it. And at that point, I had been knitting different types of things like sweaters and hats. So I had some idea of how to create different shapes using stitches. So I just made some really simple little toys for them. And the first one that I made, when I put the eyes on it and it was looking back at me, it was like this really magical moment. And it was really like that. Instantly, I had a feeling like I have to make so many more of these. It's just like too much fun I already knew that I like to create things with my hands, but to make something that can look back at me and we can have a relationship like that, it was very exciting.
Yeah. So are you self-taught then with your techniques and making all of these small, unusual shapes?
Well, I don't know if you can exactly call it self-taught, because it's, you know, it definitely comes out of a craft where along the way I've had a lot of people, especially my mother-in-law, Bonnie, have just taught me whenever I had questions what to do. And of course, there's lots of resources out there. But yeah, I don't have any kind of formal design training. And especially with what I create, which is all toys and characters, it really is great for just using experimentation. So I don't have to worry about something fitting someone like I would a sweater.
That's true.
For example.
Let's see. I definitely want to know about your workspace and your process. Just what that looks like at home. And then if you're traveling, do you have, you know, three things or more that you always have to have with you that you can keep working with?
Well, my workspace is my apartment in Brooklyn, and it's quite small. And it's a little bit crazy because I do have things that I'm working on, things that I've made for big installations that are kind of taking over mm-hmm. the space. But I have a nice, actually, the bedroom is quite big, and I have a nice desk in there. So I do have an actual workspace. It's not like I'm sitting in bed knitting all day. But I really mix it up a lot with my typical day includes so many things, and there isn't really a typical day, but I always include some kind of knitting in my day. Okay. Because I'm always working on either a design or something bigger like an installation, and it's important to me to have that time to just relax and create something. But I do a lot of writing of patterns. That's like getting down there and actually spelling out exactly how to make something, which isn't always the most fun part,
right.
But it's a great thing to do. I'm always running around going to the post office and meeting with, you know, my editor or different yarn stores in my local area.
Okay.
When I'm traveling, which I've been doing quite a bit of lately, I usually actually don't bring something super serious to work on. But I focus on ideas a lot when I'm traveling. I take my little sketchbook with me, so I can think about what I might like to get started on next and work out those things in my head first, because that's really what takes the most time is deciding on what to make and like the shape it's going to take.
Right. Well, so how does the pattern process work? Do you make something and then come up with the pattern, or does it go back and forth?
I usually take notes as I make something. It's not too difficult to look at something and figure out how I made it, but it's helpful just to kind of, so I don't have to do that and do the math and things like that. So I take really brief notes, usually just on my computer. And it's sort of a line by line, row by row, what I'm doing. But I don't know if anybody else could actually decipher that.
Right.
It's just notes. So I try to keep notes for everything, even if it's not something that will be a pattern, just in case I want to make a similar thing in the future.
Yeah.
I can refer back to it. And then when I sit down to write a pattern, it's like full sentences, and I do have to think a lot about, you know, how somebody else could interpret what I'm writing. And I have a great team of pattern testers that I send all of my instructions out to, and they can try it out and let me know how it works.
Okay. So in your progression to where you are now, how did the books come into play? Did you start seeking that out, or did someone discover you and ask you to start working on the books?
I was really lucky to be contacted by an editor, and that was about, I think about 2 years into me having a website and selling some PDF patterns online and doing some free patterns and things like that. I think she found my work through Flickr, as I remember it. That was really where I first started posting photos of the things that mm-hmm. I made. And originally it was really just like, oh, I made this cool snake.
Right.
I want everybody to see it, you know, like we all do. So I posted photos to Flickr and had some people pretty quickly get in touch saying that they wanted to make it too, and could I make patterns? So that's kind of how that all started. I got an email from an editor one day asking if I'd thought about writing a book. And at that point, it had something that was something I thought, like, maybe far in the future, if I'm lucky. So I was really thrilled. And the process was much different, of course, from what I'd been doing, because it's just a big collection of things, and you have to think about it as a whole project. And then after submitting all of the materials, it's another year before it even comes out. So it was difficult to not tell people about it. But it was really good. And right now I've been writing books about once a year for a few years. And that's been really wonderful to work on that larger project. And then at the same time, I still maintain my website and put out other designs that way. So I have that kind of instant feedback and then also the larger project to work on.
Definitely. So what's your fan base now like now? Do you interact with the community a lot? And when you do travel different places, do you have a lot of people show up that are there specifically for you?
It's really interesting. Most of my interaction with people is online, and that's really rewarding a lot of times. But of course, it's not the same as seeing people in person. And I'm always surprised at who shows up at events. I mean, it is mostly women, although there's often a lot of men because they're not gender specific, the toys that I make. But all ages. And from the beginning, you know, those first toys that I made were for my adult coworkers. Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily something that I was doing for children. Although a lot of grandmothers come who love to make things for their grandkids. Right. But I hear from all sorts of people like making something for their dad, because I have a lot of random characters.
Right, right.
And it seems like anything I come up with, somebody wants to make it for someone else.
Yes.
So it's a really good mix of ages. I've met very young knitters who are like 10 years old and designing their own things.
That's great.
And all the way up, yeah.
Yeah. Well, kind of on that same line, what role do you think that like the world we live in now with social media and memes and all the viral aspects of trends that go around, do you think that your business and success model would have worked, say, 10, 15 years ago? Or do you think that's really been a big benefit to you?
It's a huge part of what I do, yeah. And I'm not sure if I could have my same job. Of course, it would be really different if it was 10 years ago. So it's really important to me. I think I'm like a lot of other people where it's really easy to get overwhelmed by all of that and just want to like shut it out for a while sometimes. But I think people just really have true connections over social media often. You know, if you're just being yourself and putting your own work out there, showing something that you made, people react to that genuinely. And I love the way, especially that I can see what other people do with my designs. So I'll make one monkey, for example, and write down the pattern for it and put that online. And then I'll get to see 200 monkeys, and they're all completely different than other people made. And it's just, like, super rewarding.
Amongst the people that are fans of yours, is there a percentage that either just has no desire or isn't, you know, able to make things, but they just like to buy your stuff as opposed to making it themselves?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely right now all about making stuff, encouraging people to make things. So I think it's a smaller group that doesn't have any interest in that. But that's something that's been really fun about the art shows and installations that I've done, is that's when I really get to meet people who maybe have no interest in knitting, but I just get to see their instant reactions to something that I made. And then it's not about like them necessarily creating something and taking home a skill, but just seeing that like instant reaction. And when I make something like that, I try to go for images that you have an instant fun reaction to, but maybe you can linger and find some more details. So when I make something like a big landscape, I just try to include as much as possible and include a few little in-jokes if you look carefully enough. And that's really fun. I hope to go do a few more projects in that direction. So that's something I definitely have in mind. Things like stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with that in mind, how did the progression of doing installations come about? Did someone ask you to come and do a show and that kind of got it started? Or were you thinking big scale when you first started out?
Yeah, that's definitely not what I was thinking when I first started. But it helped that I, from the beginning, had that connection with a gallery. And that particular gallery that I worked at, it was called Gallery Hanaho in New York. Unfortunately, as a physical space, it doesn't exist anymore. But we were doing some shows with, like, plush art. Mm-hmm. So right at the same time that I started knitting toys, I was seeing a lot of people making kind of unconventional, interesting stuffed animals, for example, and that was very inspiring to me. And it was about the time that my first book was coming out, and I was still working with the gallery, and we were talking about, like, oh, let's do a fun book launch party or something. And then it turned into, it would be cool to make something special for that. And then it turned into, wow, why don't I, like, do this big thing, take a month or 2 months and create Mochi Mochi Land as a physical thing in real space. And after that, it just kind of led from that because it was so much fun to create that larger project that I've had some opportunities to do it again in that same space and also in Berlin and a couple other places.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, what's the furthest place that you've traveled now that Mochi Mochi has taken you to? Is it Europe or even
yeah, that
further?
would be Berlin, which I've been to twice now, actually. I had shows there both times in conjunction with a festival, an arts festival called Pictoplasma.
Oh, okay.
It's this group that's based in Berlin, and the festival is all character art. So it's all different kinds of mediums, but a lot of animation and a lot of painting and digital art. So I think my work is an interesting combination with those. And that's definitely an audience that it's not about crafting or knitting necessarily. So that's really thrilling. And Berlin as a city is just really fun.
I bet. Had you been before?
I had not, no. I just really randomly, again, it was the internet. I found this group who were putting on these festivals. They seemed interesting. They had opportunities for doing little shows. So I just got in touch with them. One thing led to another. And yeah, and I just came back in April from doing another one.
Oh, wow. Okay. And has that turned into a fan base in Germany then, or at least in Berlin? Have you noticed a difference?
Yeah. Well, actually, I was really surprised when I was there for the second time this year. Quite a few people came in saying, like, oh, I remember this from before. I really wanted to check it out. It was so cool. And what was really fun was kind of randomly it ended up on the local news in Berlin. And it's maybe a little bit similar to the U.S. where it's older people generally who are the demographic for that. So that actually brought in a lot of people who were maybe not so much in the art and animation scene to the gallery and maybe didn't speak English, also kind of older Berliners. And that was really cool to like see them there.
I bet.
Yeah, and they seemed to enjoy it, even though it was obviously something they'd never seen before.
Do you have a favorite thing to knit at this point?
Yeah, I do. My favorite thing are my tiny gnomes. I have a couple with me, actually. I can show them to you.
Sure. Are they faster, or was there a particular reason that you enjoy knitting them?
Well, I originally knit them as part of a series of little tiny characters I was making. But something about the gnomes, like, they just stuck around. They didn't really go away like the other ones did. And they are, I think, fun to knit because their body, the color changes on the body. Mm-hmm. I just do them in one piece. And so it's kind of simple in a way, but just really charming in the simplicity. And I find that they're really fun to pose for photographs, and they get up to a lot of mischief.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, that's one of the cool aspects about you coming here is that we're going to have little installations from your gnome versus snowmen. And how did you choose which ones we were going to put out? Did you kind of have a hard time deciding which ones you were going to send along?
Yeah, it was hard. So these are panels that were from a show that I did in 2011 of this epic battle between gnomes and snowmen. And it's very kind of cartoony violence kind of scenes. Some of the pieces had sold from the original
right.
show. But for this one, yeah, I just tried to think about what pieces could work on their own because these are going to be split up and not all connected together.
Right.
And then what maybe kind of symbolized the battle that was going on and the progression of it a little bit. So I hope that it's not just totally confusing for anyone who sees them.
I mean, so far the number of people that have seen the case of your stuff down in the children's department has been pretty high, and they're loving it. Just like what you were talking about kind of coming back and looking and looking again because there's, you know, small little things that they missed the first time. So I know that there'll be that aspect with the length of time that your stuff is going to be up. They're going to keep looking. Has there been any particular thing that has popped up in your career that you consider to be a big challenge of any kind, or something that you just didn't expect would ever be something you'd be dealing with while you were doing something really fun at the same time?
Can I say shipping boxes?
Sure.
I had a nightmare, like, trying to ship these, like, branches that I made things, art pieces with to Berlin recently. Anyway, so that, you know, but shipping is always complicated.
Yeah.
I guess I actually enjoy, I found that I enjoy creating challenges for myself in a way. And that's what I've done with these larger projects, is kind of come up with an idea that seems kind of crazy and maybe not even doable, and just see how far I can get with it. And I feel like that's not something I had done before I started doing this. But it's like, just give myself the time and see how far I can get with it. And then, you know, maybe also document it on my blog. So if it's a failure, at least, you know, people can see that.
Do you have something, are there still quite a few things that you want to try and do that you haven't had an opportunity to do artistically, or that maybe just hasn't come together in the way that you were starting out thinking about it?
Yeah, I guess one thing that's a little newer for me is I've been making some little animations, and that's something that I just kind of, I had always been interested in stop motion animation, but it always seemed too difficult for a number of reasons. And then finally, I just thought, why don't I make it really simple? And I started making animated GIFs, so just like little repeated motions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was super fun. So I started making some that are a little bit longer, and I loved that. And it's like, so my dream right now is to work with other people who really know what they're doing and do like a little bit bigger project. I think that could be super fun.
Well, I think I can help you with that, because we have a awesome animator professor that comes and does stop motion workshops for us. Seriously, he lives in Pennsylvania, so I'll have to connect the two of you, because he has worked on PJs and different movies and stuff, and he's coming and doing we've had him do stop motion clay for a while, but this year he's going to be doing paper stop motion, sort of like the Monty Python stuff. So anyway,
because
your animated GIFs are great. I mean, that's stop motion isn't, you know, it can be really time, you know, consuming and stuff, but you can still accomplish things even if you don't have as many frames, you know, and your stuff just is perfect for that, especially because it's just so visual to begin with. So I guess we'll finish up. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about? I know you have a new book coming out in October. We unboxed everything. Is the monster truck from the new book by any chance? Or
it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I am really excited about the new book. So I've been doing a lot of really miniature knitting up until now. But for my most recent book, I thought it would be fun to go in a completely different direction and just create huge toys. And I really didn't even think about whether or not other people would want to make them. I was just like, this sounds like a fun thing to do. And it ended up being a lot of knitting and a lot of work. It took over my life last year. So I'm thrilled that it's finally going to come out. And I think the projects are really fun. Like, they're not all epic. There's some smaller versions of some of them, too. So, but I think there is something about a larger toy, like the size of a child's, you know, a truck that he can ride around in, for example, that it kind of takes over space and it has a big personality. So I am really,
It was it's very squishable. I can see that it would be like a perfect, like kind of that new thing now where there are pillows or their pets and all that kind of stuff. So I could see a kid adopting his monster truck as his new place to hang out.
In this episode, we have music from Brian Aneurysm. The song is called Unwanted by Spectral Sound, and you can get this for free download on the library's website if you're a cardholder.